ready to start the show? You're ready to do the 16th episode of the Great American Hockey Show podcast?
I am.
All right, let's get right into it. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We're going to have Eric Joyce, the assistant GM of the Florida Panthers, newly appointed to that position and also from Dorchester.
Yep.
He'll sit in with us later, just talk about how he got involved with the Panthers and also their recent change in the front office, which has been in a lot of the news around the NHL lately, the last few days. So just for right now, though, Murph, looking at these playoffs, watching them go down, knowing the Bruins situation, who do you kind of view as some players maybe that have impressed you or might be good fits for the Bruins that have done well in these playoffs?
Well, I think, Joe, as I reported this past week, or last week, almost a week ago now, that they were very interested in Kevin Shattenkirk, a defenseman for the Blues, had a deal in place for that that fell apart at the last second. I think they definitely revisited. I just wonder, obviously, the main component of that going the other way to St. Louis was Louis Erickson, who could have helped them down a stretch and into the playoffs. Obviously, no guarantee to have him now. He's a unrestricted free agent July 1st.
Yeah, the value is not there.
The value is not there. So now you have to look at other things on your roster. You would think, obviously, the San Jose pick that's going to be at the bottom of the first round would be in there. But that's definitely not enough either. So it's going to have to be a really valuable roster player. So
Ryan
I don't know
Spooner,
if that can happen.
Frank Vetrano, yeah. David Pastrnak.
David
it's going to be a young. I don't think it's going to be Krejci because
I don't
of their
think
cap
the Blues
situation.
Could, yeah, both cap
but
situations.
It's going to be young forward yeah. Vetrano, Spooner, Pastrnak, which I don't think the Bruins will give up, and nor should they give up. But those are the kind of players that are going to be asked for from these other teams.
Right.
That's what every team wants right now,
right.
is the players that are on entry-level deals that are cheap and they're going to give you production. You know, Vetrano's an interesting one because he hasn't done a ton at the NHL level. He blew up in his first year of pro in the AHL last year, obviously had 40 goals between the two levels. But a guy like that is going to be asked for, I think, quite a bit from some of these other teams, given the shot, given the release. Given the way he's played over in Russia in the World Championships with Austin Matthews, that's the kind of guy that I think you're going to hear a lot asked for, as well as the first-round pick for San Jose, which is now going to be one of the bottom four picks in the entire first round. So I think the value has gone down in that a little bit, so you're going to have to add other things to it. But Ryan Spooner, I think, is another one you got to watch. Has another year left on his deal. Had a really good season production-wise this year. But I still get the sense like he's not a good fit for the Bruins, or the Bruins don't view him as a long-term, solution as a center. And maybe he's best as a trading chip.
Every time he goes to the wing, he seems to struggle.
Right.
I mean, give him credit. I thought he had his best professional season yet this past season. But when they needed to switch him to the wing, he struggled there. But, you look at these teams, Joe, and I think you'll agree with me that one of the key elements that has gotten the teams that are still alive right now, Tampa Bay, Pittsburgh, I think go right to the forefront there, is speed. That series is all about speed. And I don't think the Bruins have speed even close to what those teams have. So a guy I'd be targeting, you look at maybe the Tampa Bay Lightning, who have some guys coming up that, are going to be RFAs going forward. Next season would be maybe Alex Killorn or, even
Harvard
look at...
Kid.
Yep. They're going to have some salary problems. Obviously, they got to think about signing Steven Stamkos. What about Kucherov? Could you ever get him out of there? Is he going to... If Stamkos stays, some of these guys are going to become available.
Do you think there's any chance that Stamkos stays? I don't think he's staying. I think he's going somewhere else. From what I was told, people have told me that were somewhat close to him. They said he wants to go to a hockey market, like a true blood hockey market where everybody talks about it, where it gets cold in the wintertime, where it's a packed rink like a Toronto.
I don't think it's going to be Toronto, though.
No.
I really don't.
A Philly, a Toronto, a Boston, some place like that, Detroit, exactly. One of those kind of markets.
I think you're right, and I think, though, even if he was going to stay, the team might be changing their mind as we speak because Jonathan Drouin has had such a great playoff. But I would look at the Tampa Bay Lightning, really study their roster and see if any of the Bruins' needs are there, because this is a team that's going to be forced, even if Stamkos moves, they have to sign other guys. They are going to be forced to move some guys out to really identify what they want to keep so the Bruins could kind of jump in and grab a guy there. So that's an interesting team to watch. And you look, like I said, go back to the St. Louis Blues. There's some other defensemen there, too, that maybe if you want a veteran presence, a Jay Bouwmeester might be good. I think he's been really good in the playoffs. He's obviously a little overpaid, but you never know.
Yeah, I think there are different ways to deal with the speed thing too, Ro, right? I think getting a guy like Shattenkirk or getting a puck-moving defenseman, a guy that can get the puck up quickly, make decisions, make that first outlet pass, that's going to make you faster too.
Yeah.
No, that's going to make you faster too if you can just get a defenseman that can make it execute a tape-to-tape
yeah.
pass. All of a sudden, the puck's going to be moving up the ice a lot more quickly than it did last year, and it'll do wonders to make those forwards a little bit faster when he can execute those passes. We've seen he's played well in these playoffs. He struggled in the first round against Chicago, Shattenkirk, but he's done really well since then. And I got another guy in the St. Louis Blues I would look at moving forward. Cam Neely talked about defenseman, right wing, and backup goaltender as the three things they were really looking at more than anything else. How about a guy like Troy Brouwer?
Oh, good. I'm glad you didn't say David Backes.
No.
I don't go near him.
I like Troy Brouwer.
I like
Big
Troy
game
Brouwer
player.
A lot. Yep.
Plays with an edge.
Younger
has
than
some
Backes,
size.
I
think he is younger than Backes.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
And
first.
I think he's a good fit for what the Bruins need because he brings a little bit more of that Matt Beleski type snarl that he plays with. And he's another guy like Beleski that you see rise to the occasion in those biggest games and those most important games. And he's a Bruins type player. And
2 years younger than Backes, by the way.
He's the kind of guy, he wouldn't break the bank. He's put up pretty good numbers over the last few years, and he could answer your questions at right wing.
And you know what else he does? He steps it up in the playoffs.
Yep.
That's what I like about him. As the season goes on, he gets better. I mean, you can look at his stats. I was looking at this the other day when I was watching the game. As the season goes on, Troy Brouwer has consistently gotten better. He's already, like you said, he's got the cup experience with Chicago. I think it's ironic, too, that you know they traded TJ Oshie. Everyone was looking at, what are you doing for Troy Brouwer? But he's been the better part in that trade so far. So, yeah, I think that's a guy that the Bruins should definitely target. My question is, are the Blues going to want to keep him more because of his performance?
Yeah, and we'll see.
If they let Backes go.
Well, this all depends on how far the St. Louis Blues go, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if they end up winning the Cup, there's going to be a lot more pressure on Doug Armstrong to keep those players and to try to keep as many of them and retain them rather than dealing them away and letting them sign other places. Mm-hmm. But I'm for right now, I think you're in agreement with me. The offseason plan for the Bruins should just be raid the St. Louis Blues roster, take a couple of their best players, and then we'll move on. Moving on to the next segment for us, why don't we bring in Eric Joyce, the assistant GM of the Florida Panthers, newly appointed from Dorchester, a local guy, gives us some great stories and some excellent insight into the Florida Panthers' foray into advanced analytics statistics. We ask everybody at the start of the show sort of where you grew up, what your hockey background is, how you got into hockey. So just give us the sort of the story of you and where the love affair with hockey began.
So it's actually a really unique story, and it kind of goes to why I'm so motivated and dedicated to not only to winning a Stanley Cup with the Florida Panthers, but also giving back to kids. So when I was born, my dad was a Vietnam vet, and I had a pretty severe club foot. And, you know, they said it was probably associated with some of the stuff he was exposed to over there, a lot of similar type of birth defects or whatever. My mom got it corrected by a guy in Boston at Children's Hospital, Dr. Leah McKaylee, who did a great job, but you know, basically a bunch of doctors said, hey, listen, like, your son, he should be able to walk and do normal stuff, but he's never going to be able to run, or, you know, he won't be an athlete or whatever. So my mom was like, I don't accept that answer. So he went back to Dr. McKaylee and said, hey, like, what's the best thing for my son to do to kind of strengthen his legs, right? And he said, you know, why don't you put him on skates? Like, hockey players have huge asses and usually looks like they have strong legs. So just put them on skates and see what happens. And so when I was two and a half, you know, my mom took me out. We would skate around at the Divine Rink in Dorchester with a little milk crate. And, you know, obviously it's 1980 at that point. Miracle on Ice happens, and every kid in Boston wants to be, you know, Mike Ruzioni or Jackie O or those guys, and hockey kind of took off. You know, it was already taken off with Bobby Orr and the Big Bad Bruins in the 70s. And so my dad was a baseball guy and a basketball guy before he went to war. Didn't really know much about hockey, but I seemed to enjoy it, and it was definitely helped me out. So really what happened was that's how I got started. And then I played for Dorchester U still enough. I played, my mom and dad split up. I played Quincy for a little bit. I went back and played on a High Park team, you know, and they had the likes of like Mike Motto and Kevin Caulfield and those guys, Ryan Cummings and some of those guys. And then went to BC High, played there for 2 years. I got recruited to go play at the Pingree School up north. Went to prep school, had no idea that South Hamilton, Massachusetts even existed. I had no idea outside of what streets to avoid in Dorchester, really, that any place outside of like St. Mark's or St. Brendan's Parish like existed.
Right? South Hamilton's pretty different from Dorchester.
Yeah. My dad's from St. Brendan's.
Like my first day, like I get off the train, so my mom drives me to North Station. And she puts me on a train, so I drive. It's like a mile and a half walk. So, like, walking down the street to this prep school, and a kid picks me up on like a BMW. I'm like, is this like your dad's car? Like, what is this thing? And he's just like, nah, this is my car. All right. So, kind of went from there. We had a pretty good hockey team there. We competed in the ISL against some of the, you know, you're okay. But then I went and played for the Boston Bulldogs, Mike Odessa, guy who you guys probably know. And,
yep, coached at RPI, yep.
Yep, coached at RPI, and now scouts for Vancouver, I believe, and at the time scouted for the Red Wings. And so that's kind of where I had a couple options to go to college from there. I always told my mom, you know, because you took me to the rink when I was a kid, I'll get you a full ride, which – she never really believed, but I actually had the opportunity to choose between a couple good schools. I ended up choosing West Point to play, you know, Division I hockey there. And it was free, so I accomplished my goals of playing D1 hockey and paying for school, although I didn't know that the education at West Point was, like, shoved up your ass a nickel at a time. but at the end of the day, it was a great place to go and play. We were independent the first couple of years I was there, so we played against a ton of great teams from the ECAC, the Hockey East, even some of the teams out west, like Michigan and those schools. And then we joined, the time was called the Metro Atlantic Conference, and then it turned into the Atlantic Hockey Association. You know, the last few years I was there, and we were a pretty good team, but we weren't the smartest team on post. We were told that repeatedly by the commandant, whoever else, you know, wanted to make fun of the dumb hockey players. but yeah, that's how I got started. That's where I'm from. I go, you know, I drink the Erie Pub whenever I'm home. that's sort of a rite of passage. And you know, I see Kevin Hayes there, still gives me shit. Well, I think Jimmy's probably in a better personal situation. You know, he loves Boston, but he's like, why'd you get straight on and stuff? And, you know, but it's fun. Like, you know, it's a good place to be from, and great loyal people. And
hey, Eric, I did a story on the Panthers about a month ago, obviously, Vice Sports. We spoke about it, but I mean, for our listeners there, if you could just, you know, go over how you sort of got in with Panthers owner Vinny Viola and how that relationship formed and then how it led to the current job you have as assistant GM of the Florida Panthers.
Yeah, I mean, it's a unique situation. I met Vinny probably 6 years ago now. I was at the Kennedy School at Harvard. I was working a couple of jobs. I graduated from West Point, captain of the infantry. Went and served in Iraq. Got out in 2007. Went back and lived in the Middle East. Did some other work over there. And then went to the Kennedy School at Harvard. And one of my classmates, one of the guys I served with, kind of introduced me to Vinny at a Yankees game. I think he was the only guy in, like, the front row. He was sitting behind Hal Steinbrenner. Like, I knew this guy was a big guy. Right? He's like behind Hal Steinbrenner. In the Legends Club.
Jeez.
Oh, I'm sitting next to the CEO of Spalding, right? So I'm like trying to get a free basketball out of this guy, get a Mantle shirt on. and I have like a Sox hat. He's like, who's this joker with the Sox hat, like sitting in essentially the owner's box? Right? Like, and, you know, I'm like, seriously, basketball, bud, like, be quiet. You know, like, he's got a man. I'm like, mantle jersey, like, what have you done for me lately? The guy's been dead for like 10 years. Like, get out of here. So, he, you know, Vinny kind of picked up that I was a street kid first.
Yeah.
And anything kind of gravitated to that, liked it. I didn't really talk to him for a couple of years. Kind of just exchanged notes and pleasantries. And I found myself applying for a job back at West Point to teach. So I taught cadets. And, you know, lo and behold, you know, Vinny kind of was the primary funder of this center.
Mm-hmm.
So saw him there. We kind of rekindled our relationship, went to dinner with a whole bunch in the city. Was giving him advice on a whole bunch of different things. And then, you know, he kind of said, hey, I'm thinking about doing this thing with, you know, professional hockey team. Let me back up. Before that, he said, if you didn't work in government, what would you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, honestly, Vinny, I'd probably want to work in hockey, like coach or be part of a front office or maybe coach high school or prep school or, you know, someplace where I could use my education, help kids out, but also get back involved with the game that, you know, obviously has given me so much. And he said, well, you know, I'll put you in touch with Lou Lamoriello and Lou's with New Jersey. And, you know, we kind of left the conversation at that. And then the next thing I know, he's like, hey, I'm actually considering buying a team. And in fact, you know, I bought the Florida Panthers. Would you want to come work for me? So I was like, sure. Like, you know, like, that's awesome. So kind of one of those weird situations where, you know, Vinny's a unique guy. Like, he's got all this money, but he really is just a kid from Brooklyn who grew up playing street hockey. And, you know, the first thing he did when he made all of his money on Wall Street was buy season tickets to the Rangers game. Like, he'd bank, like, you know, 75% of his paycheck because he thought there's no way that this can continue. Like, I got to put a lot of money away because I'm a poor kid who grew up in a one-bedroom apartment with four brothers and sisters. And my dad was a milkman. But he said, I splurged on Rangers season tickets because he just identified with hockey players. Like, he never really played hockey, played street hockey, like I said.
Uh-huh.
But he identified with the players because the players were normal people. You know, they're not like the galactic old baseball player of the Yankees of their heyday. And, you know, some of the Knicks. And he thought that the hockey guys are just regular guys who really like to play a super fast sport and compete and fight. And he's like, that's what I like to do. I like to play, you know, play sports and occasionally get into a street fight. So that's what he did. Like, he bought Rangers season tickets, and, you know, he still tells that story today. And anyways, he buys the team, and he says, I need you to go down there, and I want you to work for Dale. I want you to be his assistant, you know, meaning just try to learn as much as you can from Dale, and, you know, we'll see where it goes. Maybe you like it, maybe you don't. But help Dale out. Like, whatever he needs done, do that. I just said, sure. Like, that. So that's kind of how I grew up, right? That's how kids from Dorchester, you know, and other places, especially kids in the military, like, you don't, like, you view yourself as part of a team.
Yeah.
And so I just, like, went down and said, Dale, I'm here. Whatever you need to do, I'll answer your phone, whatever. And, you know, the great thing is Dale's an incredibly gracious guy, right? He puts the scowl on, he plays the part, and at the end of the day, he's sort of like, you know, sort of like a teddy bear in the sense where he really cares about the people that work for him, cares about the organization, and he just wants to win. And so he kind of talked to me about, you know, here's how I evaluate players, you know, and I kind of told him, hey, listen, like, you know, I played the game for 25-plus years, too, and I wasn't always the best player on the ice, so I had to spend a lot of time evaluating my competition as well in order to just be effective out there. This is what I see guys doing. This is where I see the game going. And he listened. You know, most guys, NHL GMs, they're just like, you know, okay, like, who's this kid telling me how he sees the evolution of pro hockey? He's worked in it for 5 minutes. But Dale actually took the time to listen to me, and we formed a pretty good relationship. And then, you know, got to the point where last year, or 2 years ago now, Vinny said, Eric, I want you to go, I want you to go run our minor league team, because Dale has got a million things going on in Florida. We're trying to build, we're trying to rebuild the entire culture down here.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to stay in Florida. I need you to go to San Antonio and make sure that these kids feel like they're part of the process, right? So we talked a lot. We talked to guys a lot about trust in the process, but trust is a two-way street. You got to show them some TLC too, right? You have to make sure that our minor league ops are run, you know, like Florida. Guys get treated like they would get treated in Florida. And you got to institute that for me in San Antonio. And I said, that's an honor, and I'd be honored to do it. So I went down, and that's where I met Tom Rowe.
Great guy,
he's coaching down there at the time. And obviously, we, you know, he's a Lynn guy. And, you know, we hit it off, and Scotty Allen's a New Bedford guy. He was the assistant coach. So at the end of the day, we kind of hit it off and had a very successful season in San Antonio last year. A lot of great players down there. It's a real testament to our scouting staff. I know a lot of people use the term analytics, or Joycey's an analytics guy. I mean, for me, like, analytics are just looking at every single data point you can get, whether it's a scout telling you about a guy's character or how a guy skates, or, you know, an Excel spreadsheet telling you, you know, when this guy's on the ice, good things happen. When this guy's on the ice, not so good things happen. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a combination of the two. You know, but at the end of the day, like, formed a good relationship, had a lot of great players, like I said, the scouting staff. Just over the course of time, and really with budgetary constraints, like unbelievable budgetary constraints, like catching rides with other team scouts because we couldn't afford rental cars because Florida was just, you know, a mess. Had really assembled a quality group of guys. And we had a great year last year, kind of reassembled the team this year. And when I looked at our team in Portland this year, I'd say, hey, I think we're one of the most successful AHL teams in the league, even though we lost in the first round of the playoffs to Hershey. Well, what did we do? So 11 of our players got called up for over 200 games. And those guys contributed to the Florida Panthers winning the Atlantic Division, you know, which was a huge step forward for our organization. And we made the playoffs in Portland. So it wasn't like we necessarily suffered because our good young players got called up. We continue to sustain a winning atmosphere and a winning culture in Portland. And really, that's what the minor leagues are all about. And that's kind of the attitude and culture that, I, you know, when Vinny gave me the job 2 years ago, that I try to bring down to our minor league team. Now I'm moving Springfield to third city in 3 years. We'll try to do the same thing there for the great fans in Springfield. Not sure what the name's going to be yet. Indians are out.
Yep. Well, I'll tell you what. When you get to Springfield, I got a place that can become your eerie pub for you out there. I know the area well. So we'll discuss it. There's some good little funny, haunts.
What was funny was, so we're sitting in the office, right? And it's really just a group of civic guys. They have no idea about hockey. So myself and Peter Luco flew up.
Oh, yeah. Peter UMass Luke, guy.
Peter Luco's our... Yeah, he's a UMass guy. He's our executive chairman. Obviously, he was the president of Flyers for 20-plus years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we fly up. And the first thing he says, the guy, you know, Paul says, gives us the spiel. These guys are civic leaders in Springfield. They have no idea about hockey, like I said. And they say, you know, what are your concerns? You know, he said, listen, everybody knows that the knock on Springfield is a pretty dangerous place.
Crime, yeah.
Downtown's not that great. Players don't really like it here. And the guy goes, wait a second, stop. He goes, Peter, you're from Worcester. Eric, you're from Dorchester. And your GM is Tom Rose from Lynn. And you guys are scared about coming to Springfield? And I was like, that's a great point. You got us. Like, well, have to move past that one.
So, yeah.
you mentioned analytics before, and I just want to get your take in general. Just what do you feel like are the most valuable things within the statistical analysis, the whole sort of world of it that you use more than anything else on a daily basis evaluating players? What do you think has true value of the millions of different sort of stats or things that are being created these days? And what do you find yourself going back to and saying that's one that passes every single test and is really kind of a gold standard for something we're going to use to acquire players?
I mean, I'd like to tell you that there's a silver bullet, but really it's depending on what, it's like, what do you need as a team? And when do you need that player? Right? So if you need more of a physical presence on the blue line because you're losing puck battles down low, that's a very different look than if you need secondary scoring, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's just take secondary scoring as an example. Like, actually, let's take secondary scoring with speed as an example, right? Last year, our recommendation was to try to acquire Riley Smith from the Boston Bruins, right? Because we felt he could provide secondary scoring. He'd done it consistently up to last 2 years ago. But he added another element. He added some speed, right? And if you took a look at the Florida Panthers roster, not last year, but 2 years ago, one of the things I think we lacked was speed. And so we made the decision to give up secondary scoring to Jimmy Hayes to acquire secondary scoring to Riley Smith. And the reason we did that was Boston was looking for a bigger physical kind of Zdeno Chara net front presence where on the power play, where that player can be effective at putting pucks home, at a 20 to 25 goal rate. So we made the decision then to say, okay, well, what does Riley Smith do well? You know, he does a lot of the same things Jimmy does well, but he adds some speed. And that's really a subjective assessment of Riley based on our scouting reports versus sort of a numbers-driven, okay, this guy has X possession and Jimmy only has Y. So let's make the trade because we think possession is the silver bullet. You know, like, and when I say possession, really, is this guy, when he's on the ice, does he generate more shots than he gives up? You know, and there are certain players that don't do that. There are certain players like Erica Branson on our team that if you look at his Corsi numbers and you're just a guy sitting behind a computer, you know, you might say, oh boy, like, he's not contributing, but you're not really watching the full picture of who Erica Branson is, right? He plays in all the hard minutes. Like, he's a physical presence. He protects his teammates. He allows them to be who they are, whether he's on the ice or just sitting on the bench, right? So there's value to that too. And how we measure that, you know, we do that week to week, month to month, year to year. And we try to get down to a dollar figure based on a bunch of different inputs that we feel comfortable with, you know, and that's sort of how it's done. It's really not kind of, boy, this guy's Corsi's better than that guy. I mean, Corsi in and of itself is literally just counting, right? So when people say advanced analytics, you're talking for the most part about counting shots for and against. So it's not really advanced. Now, we have a math professor on staff, Brian McDonald, that, you know, has a PhD in, you know, advanced math from John Hopkins, and he does a whole different group of equations, that tell us this guy versus that guy, and based on every dollar in the league, production should equate to this much money for next year, and given his age and kind of the development curve of players, you know, this guy's good for a 2 year term, plus or minus a pretty healthy variance, you know, and then it's up to us to say, well, we know his agent. We know who he trains with, and, you know, scouts come in and say, this guy trains his ass off. Like, so if the average guy drops at this age, you know, add 3 years to him because, like, I've never seen a guy work that hard, you know, so then, or conversely, this guy, you know, maybe has a little too much fun or whatever, right? So
what's interesting to me is, like, let's say you're talking about a player and, I mean, a lot of it was interesting, but the one thing that I come back to is you, searching for an answer for is, you see a player, right? And we know when you're in a room, whether it's, you know, you're going to draft a player, whether it's somebody you're thinking of signing, trading for, you know, everybody in a collaborative room in a team environment has their opinions on a player. Some people feel, you know, more strongly than others. All things being equal, or when it's a pretty equal between two players, and, you know, one has a little bit better as far as the numbers go, and one, you know, the eyeball test passes a little bit more. Like, how do you make that decision between those two players when they're sort of side by side? And I realize that may not happen that often, but if theoretically something like that did happen, sort of, you know, how do you come about making that decision?
Yeah, hopefully you get both of those guys if they're really good.
You know what I mean, though, if it's like filling a particular spot that you have in a need on a team, maybe, you know, whether you only need one of, you know, a big stay-at-home guy that you want to go out and get, or, you know, a power play guy for the point or whatever. You know, a guy that fulfills a certain role where you're looking at a couple of different choices for that one particular position.
So holding everything else constant, meaning like we get the same guy, like one of these guys for the same price tag, for the same term, you know, all that stuff.
Right.
Like if it's a 1-year, $5 million deal for player X or player Y.
Right.
One guy's a little bit better statistically, and another guy's a little bit better, you know, I would go with that guy. For me, 100% of the time, it's the scouts. Right? Like, there has to be something this guy has done to impress upon them his value to our team. And all my job is, in the position I'm in now, you know, I'm one of the leaders of the organization, right? Leadership is, to me, it's all about service. It's about service with a vision, really. So you have to empower your scouts to have the final say, because these are the guys who are in the ring 24/7. And that's sort of how it's done, you know. Like, we defer to the scouts all the time if it's, all things being equal. It very rarely is all things being equal.
Right.
Because there's guys with different contracts, guys, you know, one guy might be 32, another guy might be 28, so, you know, all these different variables enter in. But if everything else is equal, then the scouts get the final say. Because we trust those guys implicitly to do right by the organization. And, you know, and it's not, you know, there's no divide between analytics and scouts. So, like, you know, the computer guys, I wouldn't even say that. The analytics guys aren't like, ha, you know, the player you told us to acquire sucked.
Right,
you got my guy. Once the decision's made behind a closed door, we leave the room and say, this is the organization's decision. And like I said, it's one, like, if it's all things being equal, then the scouts get the final say.
Before we let you go, I need to ask you, have to get from you, if you have any kind of Jaromir Jagr story you want to share with us, because I know we have ours from when he was in Boston, and just like the aura that guy has when he's in a room is just different than, you know, everybody else in the dressing room. Even on a great Bruins team, he just had this sort of different light on him in the dressing room when you were talking to him and when he was around. Just in your time that you've spent around him and around the organization, anything that comes to mind about Jags?
You know, for me, the word humble comes to mind. Like, for a guy with so much accomplishment and who's, you know, obviously a pillar of the game, a legend within the game, you know, he just brings that lunch pail mentality to the rink every day. Like, and obviously, you know all the stories, right? He skates every day. Mm-hmm. He skates after game. He skates the fastest rink until midnight. Like, and for us, the reason that we acquired him was twofold. One, like, even when he had 12 points in the jersey and was only playing 10 minutes a night, we said every time this guy's on the ice, good things happen. Like, he might not be getting points, but that's a function of, you know, who the goaltender he plays that night, or, you know, maybe his teammates, they hit a pipe, or, you know, whatever. But at the end of the day, like, he's generating quality opportunities for his teammates, so he's a good player still, right? And secondly, you got a kid like Barkov who's sitting here, like, yearning for leadership. And not only leadership that, like, you know, obviously authority provides a tremendous amount of leadership to the dressing room, Derek McKenzie, mentioned Eric DeBranson, Willie Mitchell last year. I mean, these guys are winners at every level. But for kids like Barkov, put him on a line with the guys he basically grew up idolizing, elevated him to a level that I think he was always capable of getting to, but way faster. And also Johnny Huberdeau. Like, Johnny Huberdeau's a guy who had a great rookie season, had a, you know, okay second year. And then when Yaz got there, put him and Barkey on a line with Yaz was, like, solid gold for us. And the fact that Yager came in and was as humble as he was and was as patient with these kids as he was absolutely awesome. Like, I've never seen anything like that before, you know, because you'd expect a guy like that to have a little bit of a chip on his shoulder, kind of walk with a certain swagger, be sort of an untouchable, kind of say, yeah, it's a great kid. But, I mean, he basically would take Yager, or he would take Barkov and Huberdeau aside after practice and kind of be their coach too. And say, okay, when I'm here, you need to do this. When I'm there, let's do this. Okay, we're on the power play. This is how it's going to run. And these kids would just sit there with their jaws, like, you know, open, being like, oh, like, this is unbelievable. Actually, the results speak for themselves. Led our team in points this year. You know, Barkov, Selke, not a finalist, but nominated for the Selke Trophy. He's one of the best two-way guys in the league. And Hubie's, you know, had another great year statistically for us. So that's really the one word that comes to mind. And it's not one specific story. It's just the attitude that he brings. You know, when he's in your room and he's doing those things, like, what excuse does player X have?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's what it's all about. It's about eliminating excuses for guys. And that's what we try to do. It's the flip side of our job is to really provide the guys with everything they need to be successful. So there's none of this BS with didn't get that or didn't have this guy or that guy. Like, one of the greatest players in the game is sitting in the room doing what he is doing for the love of the game. If you have no excuse, you have to go the extra mile. So
good stuff.
Awesome, Eric. Thank you very much. I'm supposed to go golfing with Mike Motto next week, so I'm going to make sure I get some good Eric Joyce stories from back in the day when I talk to him.
Boss, I don't think he remembers playing. He's like a Galactico on that team.
Like I'm going to see if he remembers. I'll let you know what he says. Thanks a lot, Joycey.
Well, I was a GM in San Antonio, too, so tell him we still use Motto lefties. The coaching staff still uses his stick. That'd be very budget conscious in Florida.
I'll let him know. I'm sure he'll appreciate they were recycled.
All right.
Take care.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Man. Appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Peace.
Have a good one. Bye. Bye.
And for the last segment to close things out, best and last, Kevin Paul DuPont from the Boston Globe. You've been on with us before on the Great American Hockey Show podcast.
And you've still got the show.
That's it. You still got the gig going on here. And so do I. Your just take right now where the Bruins are after all the press conferences, after all the show ponies were trotted out, after all the buses were driven over certain individuals. What do you take from all of that, where they're headed, what they're doing? I mean, I'm pretty well documented. I think Felger is too, that we think they're in trouble. And I think to a degree, Murph definitely too.
Yeah.
Feels like they are too. What's your sense? What's your temperature right now, the Bruins?
Yeah, I don't know if it's rudderless, but it's certainly it's kind of TBA hangs over the whole thing, in my feeling. That said, they were in a very similar predicament 10 years ago, and they went out and got Chara. And things turned around dramatically around Chara.
Right.
And you always have to have goaltending, right? If you don't have it, you're cooked. And there were certainly times during the course of the year they didn't have goaltending. But I think, and again, this is open to some debate, I think Rask is a legitimate goaltender. Is he a truly elite goaltender? I don't think he can be that when you're as inconsistent as he was this year. But I'm happy with that. I'm not happy with the defense.
Right.
I would be far happier with the defense if they could go out in 10 years later and get a reasonable facsimile of Zdeno Chara. He was $7.5 million a year 10 years ago.
Yep.
So to get that same player today, that's a franchise probably max contract, you know, and they're not around. So how are you going to do it? You're going to have to do it with youth. By my eye, you're going to have to do it with youth. Maybe a prudent UFA signing back there who's a if it's not a 20-22-minute guy, maybe it's a 14-16-minute guy who can play with some impact. And then you've got to get legitimate NHL forwards who can score regularly, and they don't have that right now. So,
do you have a confidence level, though, that the people that are in place now are going to be able to do that? I mean, if for a great GM, for a great front office, it would be a tremendous task, I think, to find that next Zdeno Chara, or to find anybody that you're going to be able to put in there and be a number one defenseman, play 25 minutes a night, say 23 to 25, do what they're going to have to do to get you deep into the playoffs, sustain that for 2 months during the postseason. You know, we've talked about it a little bit. It's pretty well documented the last 7-8 years, whatever, basically since the lockout, where they lost the season, that if you don't have a guy that's 25-ish to 33 years old that can play 30 minutes a night in the playoffs, that's a number one defenseman in all situations, you're not going to win the cup. And you're sort of just playing for, you know, second, third, fourth place down the line. Right? Do you have confidence that they're going to be able to find that guy out there when that would be a Herculean task for anybody?
It is Herculean. I'm not convinced. Let's put it this way. I think Don Sweeney is learning a lot on the job.
Yep.
And I think this is a very difficult league for on-the-job training. You know, I know there was a whole lot of time spent last month about who is in charge, who isn't. Well, I've never considered, from the day he got here, Cam is the guy who's setting the tone for personnel. I've never believed that. That's not why he was hired. That's not who he is. He's spoken quite freely over these last however many years that he doesn't do that. He comes in more as at times a galvanizing voice. That's really got to be Sweeney in the scouting department.
Nor does he want to be the guy, right, that's staying up late at night watching film and, you know,
no. Pouring
over scouting reports and spreadsheets and all that.
I don't think he wants it, and I don't think anybody should think he's equipped to do it.
Right.
I don't think he is. I don't think he's ever pretended to be that. And again, those jobs, to be a general manager, the most important part of the general manager is one job: determining who can play and who can't play. The rest of it, it might be important about marketing and dog and pony shows between the period and the game enhancement and all that BS. It comes down to, can you tell who can play? And frankly, they've for the last 3 to 5 years here have let too many players go who could play and then didn't get fair value back. So they have bollocks the equation, and they've got to do a far better job of maintaining assets and having a much sharper eye on who can play and who can't.
On that note, Dupes, we just had a new assistant GM of the Florida Panthers, Eric Joyce, on before you, and he was discussing, Joe had asked him, you know, what is the role that analytics play, and what is the final say? Is it analytics or is it scouting? He says, look, analytics obviously is becoming playing a much bigger role, and we definitely use it, but when it comes down to it, it's my scouts. And furthermore, I like to make the scouts feel like they have almost final say. I mean, yes, the GM and the director of hockey operations are going to make the actual final say, but the scouts need to have the confidence that we're going to accept their evaluations. With that being said, and connecting to what you just said, is scouting both at the amateur and pro level maybe a major area right now that the Bruins really have to evaluate? Because like you said, they've let players go that they shouldn't have. Yeah. They've kept players that they haven't. And if you talk to so many different scouts and you know, executives across the NHL, they saw a decline in Zdeno Chara in that Montreal series that they lost in 7 games in 2014. And it seems to me, from the outside, that wasn't identified as much here as it was around the NHL.
Well, I think there's always a tendency. That's a great point. I think there's always a tendency to fall in love with your players, right? Part of the hand in hand with the general manager's role of knowing who can and who can't is then not to fall in love with those who you think can.
Mm-hmm.
But I think no matter who was in that job, be it Chiarelli or Sweeney, they would have to see that Chara's skills have diminished. It took a more severe hit, if you will, because of what happened to Seidenberg. Seidenberg's game fell off as well. So I think part of that is hand in hand. I don't know how much, to go back to where you started your question about analytics, I really don't know how much they utilize them in this organization.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be a drastic mistake for any organization really to rely just on numbers, or forget just on numbers. to put an overemphasis on numbers. And I think one of the great lessons in this town was to see basically John Henry's mea culpa this spring training, finally, after, you know, after, yeah. And he said, you know.
It was great.
Yeah. Well, what woke you up to this, John? The results. Well, yeah. Guess what? That's usually is what it's about, right?
I think we're going to see that in Arizona soon.
Yeah. You just can't.
Yeah, their computer that was making all the decisions, I think, finally got put to the scrap heap, thank God.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's obviously a valuable tool. My instinct, and never done the job day one, so what's my instinct worth? Who knows? Is that it would be more a tool to convince me not than to convince me to. Yeah. So if I'm seeing something and I really like a guy or I'm really feeling good, and now I go to the numbers and my numbers guy says, I really don't know what you're seeing because look at all these. That could start to sway me.
Okay.
And a perfect example for my money of this entire conversation was Benoit Pouliot and the contract he got in Edmonton, where they were going basically strictly on the numbers and the stats that he was putting up. And they're now, I think, at the end of this past season, they were looking for ways to get rid of him or not happy with what they were getting out of him. And he was too inconsistent. They couldn't rely on him to do certain things. He was making too many mistakes, too many offensive penalties in the offensive zone. All the things that everybody that's seen him over the years knows is a part of his game. They're starting to realize it now, like 2 years after they signed him to this mega deal, that anybody with their eyeballs that watched him play could have told you when they signed that contract, this is the player that you're getting. He's talented, but these mistakes just dogged him everywhere he went.
Right, mistakes, skills, also complacency once they have deals. As in all sports, there's a whole lot that gets baked into the cake. There's a fair number of guys who perform far better when they're on 1 and 2 year deals.
Should Bruins fans be rooting for Jumbo Joe Thornton to win the cup? Do you feel like there's any sentimental value to this as he's deep into these playoffs? I don't feel like it's Ray Bourque winning the cup with the Colorado Avalanche. I think some people are, you know, there may be some revisionist history going on where some people are treating it that way, but I just don't feel that way.
Yeah, I think it's easy to feel good for Joe because of who he is.
Of course.
To use my friend Dale Arnold's expression, there's never a bad day on Planet Joe. Yeah. But it's, you know, he wasn't there. He wasn't here all that long. That said, he was actually here longer than Esposito. So from being drafted in 97 to leaving in November of 2005, he had a good run. He had a lot. He had a very long learning arc. And he was not there when they moved him. Now, is that the reason to move him? I don't necessarily. At the time, I was okay with what they got back. History has proven it wasn't okay what they got back.
Right.
But when you looked at it, they got some decent parts that probably should have done better.
Yeah.
Stewart was a very serviceable defenseman. They only wish they had that kind of player right now, as a matter of fact. Sturm had injuries. The rest of it, Primo was what he was. But so, you know, the deal made sense. But again, as they did with Sagan, and this is the best two examples are moving Sagan and moving Joe, didn't gin up the market at all. It made a very quick
knee-jerk reaction.
Somebody may say impetuous or knee-jerk. They wanted to get rid of him. They wanted to do it. They did it. I think in both cases they could have ginned up the market and done better.
Regrets or second thoughts, or you know, no pun intended, with the column that you write about that column that you wrote about him
about Joe?
Turning down the giving back the
not
C
at all. No, in fact, I've actually felt, lack of a better word, vindicated, because I didn't say in the column trade Joe. I said this is not a guy who should be wearing the C, because if you can't grasp dealing with the media. In the biggest moments of there are no bigger moments for the Bruins than Game 7 against Canadiens.
Yep.
I don't care if it's Game 7 against Anaheim for the Cup or Chicago, Game 7 against Montreal.
Having blown a 3-1 lead.
If you can't grasp that, having gone 0-0-0 for your own production.
Yep. The full Thornton as it became.
The full Thornton.
Thank you to Kevin Paul DuPont, trademark.
You've got to grasp that moment. If you don't grasp that moment, well, I don't think you're ever going to get it. And I think that's true. And in fact, to revisit that column, I don't think he ever got it really in San Jose either.
Right. Well, that's why he lost it there.
Yeah, he's been maybe that's why he lost it. Yeah. Maybe. But He sure looks to me like he's a better performer without it. Because right now, this is the best I've seen him.
Well, before. And also because he's like the third or fourth banana on that team now, behind Joe Pavelski, behind Brent Burns.
Yeah.
He's not the franchise number one guy on that team.
And, you know, I talked to P.J. Stott. I did a story on Joe last month. And I just talking to former teammates, what they've thought of his progress, his maturity now, and how he handled losing the C in San Jose. And they said, you know what? I think he wanted it. I don't think – wanted to lose it, that is.
Yeah.
And I don't think he ever wanted it in Boston.
I don't know.
I think it was forced upon him, and I agree with them. It was Glenn Murray, P.J. Stock, both said that, and they said, we knew in the locker room that was not going to be a good move.
Yeah.
And we just said, that's not Joe. Joe is laid back. He just wants to feed it to us in front of the net, and that's it. And everybody else wanted Cam Neely. They wanted this big, tough guy. And I think the problem was nobody wanted to accept Joe for what Joe was. That's the way I looked at it, and I think now that that's happened in San Jose, he seems more comfortable, and he's really having probably his best playoff ever.
Absolutely, because I've seen him go into that same sort of funk on the international stage playing for Team Canada in the Olympics,
yeah, good
and
point.
You look out there, and it's that same sort of – you can't say it's just a disimpassioned – it's just who he is. It's like that's not in his DNA to
right.
be the guy in the moment. He does. He has in this playoff. He looks like he's really enjoying it. It looks like he's in the moment, as Kessel did last night,
oh
especially.
My gosh.
That's the best game I've seen from Kessel. And that's always been my complaint about, listen, guys, they're paying you this dough. That's easy to default to. But you're in this role to do it. Do it.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
And you can do it.
That line's been the most dominant line,
yeah.
I think, in the postseason. To date, third line on the Pittsburgh Penguins.
That's scouting right there.
Because Murph and I promised the Twitter followers we would answer questions, we'll just get one quick one
in.
Andrew Santinella, ATS860 on Twitter. Why do a majority of fans think that trading Krejci will make the team better? There was a second part of the question that was kind of a pejorative against Matt Kalman. We're going to skip that part of the question.
But we'll enjoy it later.
Yes, exactly. Why do a majority of fans think that trading Krejci will make the team better, Dupes?
Trading Krejci?
Yes.
I didn't know they did think that.
Yeah.
And I think if they are thinking that, I think it's misguided. I think he's a very, very good player. And again, if you're going to trade David Krejci, well, what are you getting back here?
Right. It better be that defenseman.
It better
for.
Be it better be a top pairing defenseman because he's a top
and a young guy that's signed for years to come and somebody that's going to take care of that for a long term.
Sure.
The way the team is built right now. It's built around the strength of those two frontline centermen, Patrice Bergeron and David Krejci, and that is the most important asset, along with Tuukka Rask, that they have in that team. So if you're going to alter that, you better be making it some other part of your team that much better.
I just want to ask Dupes quick, because this has been a hot topic before we go. Yeah. What about the stuff we hear about Tuukka Rask and the thoughts of maybe moving him? Is that realistic, do you think?
I think it's probably as realistic as moving Krejci. So I wouldn't think they would look to do either of those moves. I would think as an organization they would have to entertain any thoughts. But again, I think he's a legitimate top third goaltender. Maybe he's a legitimate top 15-20% goaltender. I don't know why you'd screw with that equation. Mm-hmm. He's under contract. He's a known asset. You have control of the asset. There's so many good reasons to keep him. It would have to be a sensational reason to move him. The only reason it's even in my head is because last year and this year there were times where I said, you know, is he really as good as I think he is? Because there's a lot of times I think he's a terrific goaltender. But I think by and large the deal is stacked toward keeping him more than letting
him. Let's see what he does with a good defense in front of him, too.
No trading Krejci, no trading Rask. As Don Sweeney said in his press conference, overhaul. We don't need no stinking overhaul. Dupes, thank you very much for being
with
us.
Yep.
Keep it great, keep it American, and always keep it about hockey.